Hi, I'm Debbie Steinberg-Kunz, licensed marriage and family therapist and founder of Bright and Quirky. I wanted to put together this little pre-summit video series to share with you some of our favorite talks from last year's summit while we wait for the summit to begin. This one is with Rini Jain, the co-author of Superpower, the book that is so phenomenal. She's got so many wonderful gems to share about anxiety. I hope you enjoy the talk. And if you want to take the work deeper, go ahead and scroll down on this page and check out the options to upgrade. Hi, everyone. It's Debbie Steinberg-Kunz, licensed marriage and family therapist and founder of Bright and Quirky. I'm so thrilled to welcome you to our 2021 summit. And I'm so excited today to talk to Rini Jain. As founder and chief storyteller at GoZen, Rini is recognized as a pioneer in marrying technology and child psychology in a unique approach that nurtures the hearts and minds of kids. Through her writing, product invention, and development, masterclasses for parents and children's advocacy, she works to build the emotional intelligence of kids, including resilience, empathy, kindness, and critical thinking. Tens of thousands of families and professionals testify to the unparalleled success of GoZen programs. Originally a tech entrepreneur who suffered with her own anxiety, Rini founded GoZen to help a new generation of kids, parents, and therapists. Rini, welcome to the summit.
Thank you, Debbie. I'm honored to be here. Very excited.
All right. Great. Well, I just read your amazing book.
Thank you.
It is such a marvel. It's really such a gift. And I think your whole mission stems from your own suffering with anxiety as a child. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So I worried as long as I can remember. I actually can't remember a time in my childhood, like below age, let's say 25, where I wasn't worried about something. And I have early memories of me asking my parents if I could sleep with my brother's wiffle bat. You know, it's like a plastic bat. It's like before baseball, a wiffle ball. Mm-hmm. And I was worried about someone robbing our house, you know, although no one in our neighborhood had ever been robbed and we had locks on our doors, but that was a worry of mine. I was worried about grades and friends and everything, you know, anything that could be a worry was a worry for me. So yes, I was a long, long, long time worrier, and my parents are loving and compassionate and awesome and amazing. And they just didn't know how to help. They did everything they could. They gave me love, overbearing love. It's probably their greatest flaw. but, you know, somehow the love couldn't quash the worry. It would make me feel better. Like they would reassure me and say, trust me and we love you and it's going to be okay. And it just didn't work. It didn't make the worry go away. So eventually I just sort of pushed it out of my thoughts, or I thought I did. I tried. Right? I tried to create this sort of force shield around myself where I wouldn't feel it. But as you probably know, as a family therapist, that when you push one feeling out, you push them all out, right? You don't actually push them out. They're still there, buried, stuck. But you don't feel the good or the bad. Eventually, I just became sort of this stoic robot pretending everything was okay. And then I got a little bit older. And I didn't know how to handle really life at all. So anything that disturbed my existence, you know, any problem, any challenge, and big challenges, forget it. I just didn't know how to handle it. So by my mid-20s, I was having severe panic attacks, you know, the kind where if you've ever had a panic attack, you know, for those of you listening, where you are clutching your chest, and you have shortness of breath, and you think, like, this is it. Like, this is, I'm taking my last breaths. These are the moments, like the last moments of my life. So I had a few of those before I was like, okay, I need to do something, to change something. So I ended up in therapy, which is a gift, you know, and as I was there, already had a degree in finance and was working in technology, right? So nothing to do with what I do now. but I was lying on this sofa and I just shot up. I sat up and I was like, oh my goodness, wait a second. Why didn't I learn this as a kid? Everything you're teaching me, I could have learned as a child. And so that started me, you know, many years ago on a path to, of course, I don't have a time machine, so I couldn't heal myself or give myself advice directly. But it started me on a path of reaching as many kids as possible with skills, with life skills. So that's sort of the genesis of the work that I do.
So amazing. So amazing. Well, let's dive in. And I cannot recommend your book highly enough.
Thank you.
Yeah. So in your book, you talk about 5 superpowers and this idea that we were born with the superpowers. We might have lost touch with them. They might have gotten zapped and that we can get them back, which I think is an absolutely amazing idea. Can you tell us about this?
Yeah. So, you know, this book was published by Penguin Random House and it's nothing to do with plugging my publisher. They're great. But the reason that I bring that up is because they reached out to my co-author, Dr. Shefali, and I, and they said, can you write a book on getting rid of anxiety for kids? And we said, no. They were like, what? We're like, we don't want to write a book on getting rid of, you know, because this is part of our humanity. It's part of who we are. It's part of the spectrum of emotions that we have. And so we want to write a book on transforming. We also don't want to write a book on, you know, like, get rid of something that's wrong with you. You're wrong. And this is a fix it book. I didn't want to write a fix it book because I deeply and truly believe that we come into this world whole. No matter what level of consciousness we have or what our abilities are, I believe every single child comes into this world with a particular set of superpowers, right? Some of them are different than others, but a bunch of them we have in common. So the premise of this book is that you come into the world with the strength that you need to transform anxiety. And all we're doing in this book is, one, reminding you that you have these powers. We're not just going to pat you on the back and say, oh, you have superpowers, you're awesome. We're going to map out each power and show you how you had them, have you remember them, right? And then reactivate them. And then, as you mentioned, you know, we talk about in the book, well, okay, if I had all these superpowers and I was so great, like, what happened? Why do I feel this way? Why do I feel what many kids are feeling, overwhelmed and chronically worried and unable to cope with the challenges they face? And so we talk about, well, your powers got zapped, you know, as you went along in your life, they got zapped. And that basically means that they're latent inside of you. They're buried and you need a reminder to reactivate them. So that's sort of the premise of this book.
Wonderful. And you talk about the reasons that they get zapped. And many of those reasons are shoulds. Mm-hmm. Can you help us understand?
Yeah. So we, you know, in the book, we talk about getting shoulded on and shoulding on other people in a playful way. We all have shoulds in our life, you know, and some of these shoulds have come from our parents and some have come from culture and some have come from, you know, maybe a magazine we read or a TV show or a friend. And they come from all different sets of places, right? We have a set of beliefs that you believe you should be achieving something. You believe you should be moving toward a particular goal. Maybe you believe you should be a particular size and weight. So we all have these shoulds, and we are not saying that they are inherently bad. Most of the time when our parents or we as parents are giving our kids a should, you know, you should work to your potential. We're doing it out of great love, compassion, great intention. We want them to fulfill their life and be happy, right? But what happens is there is a disconnect where a lot of times if the should is some goal that we want our kids to meet, that they then believe that they need to meet. Along the path to the goal, all the points along the way to the goal, they don't feel worthy, right? They're not enough until they have achieve this certain thing. So if you believe that you should go to an Ivy League school, or you should, you know, be a football star, or you should be a math whiz, right? Because you have some raw talent that's been expressed in some way, or someone believes that they saw in you. Well, okay, that's okay, right? To have a goal. It's amazing to have a goal. We were talking earlier, Debbie, and I was saying, like, come from Indian immigrant parents. They had lots of goals for me, right? But the problem is the disconnect between working toward mastery and working toward a goal and feeling like, if I am not this in this moment, I am not enough. I am not worthy. And until I reach this goal, then, you know, I'm not good enough. And then what happens when we do reach the goal, what we see is that the goalpost starts to move. Okay, well, you know, we see this as adults all the time. I wanted the raise. Maybe I want a set of resources, like X amount of money is going to make me happy, or this house, you know, it doesn't always have to be material. Maybe it's something else. If I read 100 books and I'm like the most well-read in this year, then I will be spiritually awakened and I'm going to feel great. And then we do it, right? We hit our goal. And then what happens? It's like, okay, well, that's not enough. We are terrible at savoring, right? We're not good at sitting in that moment. We forget our success and we're looking at the next goal. And so we're shooting ourselves. And so that was kind of a long answer to what you asked me. Where do those superpowers go? We get shooted on, and we begin to should on ourselves to the point where we feel like, in order to be whole and worthy, in order to enjoy anything, we need to reach the next milestone.
You know, what's so fascinating to me is, we live in this medical model where anxiety is a diagnosis, and this diagnosis has certain signs, and there's a treatment plan for anxiety. But the way you're talking about it, and the way I have come to see many, neurodiverse brains and situations, especially the situation we're living in right now, sheltering in place, it sure doesn't feel like a diagnosis needing a treatment plan. It's really a way of life, a way of interacting as a family, a way of interacting with the world, self-love. Is that sort of your take also?
Absolutely. So I'm not saying that if you have a child that's anxious, as I was a child that was anxious, that you don't have suffering, that there aren't things that could be different, you know, that there aren't hurdles. But my understanding of anxiety, having gone through it personally and now working with thousands of families with kids having this experience, is that, one, we have a misunderstanding of it, a basic misunderstanding of it, you know. For the most part, most people are very black and white about anxiety. It is not good for you and you should get rid of it, right? We have been told over the years that chronic stress is going to kill us, that it's going to lead to every medical condition known to man, right? Like from heart disease to obesity to, they link stress and anxiety to everything. And I'm not sitting here saying, I'm not an MD, so I'm not sitting here saying that chronic stress, you know, for prolonged periods of time are good for your body. But what I am saying is there's a much more nuanced understanding of anxiety when you actually dig into the work around it and you dig into the research around it. And you will find lots and lots of interventions, plenty of which we have put into the Superpowered book, which show you how to change your relationship with your anxiety. And in this modification, in this change, you start to use it. You don't get rid of it. You begin to transform it. So for example, you know, an example that maybe many people have heard before, if you're going up to give a speech, a presentation, this is a challenge environment for you, a performance environment for you. So it could be a speech, it could be taking a test, anywhere where you have to perform, essentially. You can take your anxiety and you can begin to have a conversation with it. And instead of feeling like, I'm so nervous and I'm so anxious and I'm going to, you know, I need to calm myself down, what you want to do is jump from the anxiety to excitement, physiologically very similar and say, oh my goodness, yeah, I'm feeling butterflies in my stomach. I'm so excited. My hands are sweating. I must need a little bit of motivation right now in order to perform. And what the research shows is that in reconstructing this from an anxious experience to a challenge experience, that you're using that stress that's in your body to your advantage, that you get more focused, more creative, and you end up performing better. Better than even if you tried to take deep breaths and calm yourself down. So getting rid of, and this black and white approach to like, just get rid of it. Or, oh my goodness, my kids are anxious. Now I'm feeling totally uncomfortable because I've been told that like, that's so bad for them. I think we need to have a more holistic understanding that every feeling has a purpose. Not every reaction, you know, has a good purpose, but every feeling has a purpose. And getting rid of, you can read, you will probably not find any piece of research on suppression and getting rid of that shows benefits.
Yeah. And you make the point in the book that worry can be very helpful. If there's a dangerous situation, you want to mobilize and get away from that danger.
It's the first thing that when I work with any kids that we teach them, let's talk about all of the advantages of worry and the situations in which it can actually help you. Because all of a sudden now, worry isn't a demon anymore, right? And just like in the movie Inside Out, which was an animated movie that won an Academy Award where they personified emotions, we personify emotions in the book. And so let's make it a character, you know, and not let's not make the character evil, right? Because he's not this character, whether you make a female or a male or, you know, whatever character you create, you know, whether it's an alien. In the book, we create Wisty the Worrier and we give it characteristics. But one of them is that this character is actually trying to protect you, right? This part of who you are is actually working to help you. And we show many different situations in which the anxiety can be helpful to you and that you just have to start creating a dialogue with it. So again, it's not about getting rid of it. It's not about necessarily even changing, right? It's about changing our relationship with, not changing the anxiety itself.
Yeah, that's so important. And I think for any families listening, it might be a really fun project. This is one of the exercises in the book, if I might share.
Of course.
Okay, to get out a piece of paper and draw a character who could be your anxiety. And should they just sort of like get out the pencils or the crayons and go nuts? How, any instructions for
Yeah, so absolutely. So I'm gonna lift this up if we can see this. So in the book, we present a character. Her name is Wisty the Worrier. So you can see we tried to make her kind of cool. But she's a messenger that actually carries messages in here in this little carrier bag. And you can see this is a dialogue that we suggest to kids to begin having with the character. So the thing about creating a character is you can just get out a piece of paper, right? And you can draw up a character. The character needs to be someone that your kids want to interact with, right? So it can be, you can name it anything that you want to. And the point is that it takes on sort of a human form, right? It takes on the form of someone that you can actually have a dialogue with. So absolutely, you can draw one up. Some kids call it Mr. Bossy Pants. Some kids call it, you know, use the suggestion in the book, Wisty the Worrier. And some other kids have a lot more creative ideas and so they're creating something else. Yes, but creating your own worry character is a tried and true therapeutic technique, right? It's something that would happen, again, everyone had the benefit of therapy. My goodness, what a different world this would be, right? But this is a technique that you can do outside the office and on your own, and you will see kids talking to their worry. My kids talk to their worry.
Yeah, what kind of things would kids talk to their worry about? And in what kind of voice?
Yeah. So worry, so again, we don't want to make it evil, right? Because worry can have a lot of benefits, but worry can also overreact. So one of the things that kids will learn in the book or, you know, in our Go Zen programs, we are teaching kids that, you know, back in the day when we were out hunting and gathering, we had a need to protect ourselves. We call this the fight, flight, or freeze response, right? And one of the things that happens is that when that response activates, your mind exaggerates things. Why? Because it wants to protect you. So you might see a stick on the ground and your brain is like, oh my goodness, that could be a snake, right? So we teach kids why the brain it exaggerates. But in that exaggeration, what happens is that we become not negative thinkers, but inaccurate thinkers, right? Mm-hmm. So when you're talking to your worry, you're not trying to get back to a place of like, yay, la-di-da-di, feeling good, you know, like just have positive thoughts. You're trying to make your worry more accurate because Wisty the Worrier is notoriously inaccurate, exaggerating mm-hmm. things, magnifying things. And you can teach kids the ways in which we become inaccurate, you know, commonly known as cognitive distortions. There are hundreds of them in which, you know, we magnify things, we minimize things, we mind read things. And so we teach the ways in which the anxiety can create a distortion. But you're going back to your question, you know, how do kids talk? First, from the premise that this is a part of me that I'm speaking to, and there is a high likelihood that if anxiety is trying to talk to me, that it's exaggerated or distorted. And so in my conversation back to anxiety, I'm like, hey, come on, you know, it's not that bad, right? It can be as simple as that. I know you're trying to make me worry. I get that you're doing, you know, you're trying to protect me, but I'm good. Like, I've got this, you know, so a simple conversation like that can work.
I think that's a really revolutionary idea for a lot of people, kids especially, to say that, you know, I have different parts of myself and I can make a character and talk to a part of myself. And I do have a deep wisdom and there is this worrier that might be inaccurate and I can have this ongoing dialogue. And in Bright and Quirky, we talk about being a self-scientist and running experiments. And this is a great way to be a self-scientist to really say, okay, worrier, let's see how accurate that is.
The great thing about it too is that it puts the power in the kids' hands. They can do it at any time. They can do it when, you know, even in front of other people, if they want to write it down, you know, if they want to do it privately, it's something that they can do on their own. So that's such a wonderful, empowering thing to have a tool that you can use on your own. You know, I would have loved to have learned something like that when I was a kid. It sounds very simple, but it's extremely empowering. And the other thing that's interesting is that you'd be surprised that from very young kids to all the way up to teenagers and even in the early 20s, they're very receptive to this technique. It's like, okay, I'm going to talk to this other part of myself instead of shutting it out. It gives them relief. You know, it's a sigh of relief, first of all, that we all have this, every single one of us, we're all connected by this, in fact, you know, and it's very easy to see now in the pandemic, everybody has it, right? Everyone's anxious and we're not getting rid of it. We are communicating with it.
Yeah, absolutely. You also had some really interesting ideas about time traveling and what ifing and some sort of traps our minds can get into that can be really distressing. Can we talk about those?
Yeah. So we talk about one of the powers that we come into the world with is presence, you know, and if anyone's ever been around a little kid, really, you know, 2 years old, 3 years old, and you try to take a walk with them, you are not walking in a straight line. Because that kid is so present that they are touching the ground and feeling the cracks or looking up at the plane in the sky or smelling what's around them, right? We come in very mindful. And Debbie, as you know, the newer part of our brain doesn't mature until the mid-20s, mid to late 20s, right? And so that it's easier for kids to be mindful. In fact, they're mindfulness masters. But as we start to mature and get older, this incredible thing happens where we begin to think about the future. And there are many scientists who believe that humans are probably the only species that can think critically about the future and make plans for the future. This is a great thing. right? We think about the future and we make a lot of contingency plans. Well, what if I, you know, yesterday I saw construction on the way home, and what if I get stuck in that construction and I'm not able to pick up my kids on time? So my brain starts routing other routes, right? My brain starts simulating. In the book, we call it a simulator. And we say, listen, when you're a pilot, let's say training, you actually are put in a simulator so that you could figure out different things that might happen and how you would react. And this is how the brain works, right? If a bird comes into the engine, what would I do? So the brain has this amazing capacity to think about the future, simulate different things. But what happens is, because our power of presence sometimes gets zapped, sometimes we get stuck in that simulation. So we get stuck what-ifing. Well, what if the bird hits my plane? What if I get stuck in traffic? What if I don't do well on this test? What if the pandemic never ends? What if school never goes back to the way it was? What if? And instead of the brain creating these contingency plans that we need it to create, right? Because we want it to, we just get stuck there and we can't come back to the moment. We can't come back to the present. So in the book, we present several different methods to bring yourself back and to also kickstart your brain's ability to create those contingency plans. One of those is simply creating an if-then plan, right? If this happens, if I get stuck in traffic, then I will take another route. So you actually write out your if-then plans and you're just helping your simulator at that point. And it gives you, you're like, okay, I have a plan, you know? And when we have a plan, the research shows that we're more likely to overcome our obstacle when we actually hit the obstacle because we plan for it in advance and we don't have to try to think about it in the moment. I don't know if you remember, or a lot of people remember it because they made a movie of it, but do you remember Captain Sully, the one who landed the plane on the Hudson? So I actually lived in New York at that time, and I saw it happen. I saw him land the plane on the Hudson. Yes, I remember calling my husband at the time, like, something is very, I don't know if I'm hallucinating, something is very wrong. But this man had decades of training. He started flying when he was like 16. When he landed that plane, he was well into his 50s, maybe even 60s, right? So he had been flying for years and years. He had military training, then he had commercial pilot training. He was a very well-trained pilot. He was an expert, right? When they interviewed him and they said to him, what did you do, you know, like when you first realized that a bird was in the engine or whatever was corrupting the engine? And he said, I pulled out the emergency checklist. And you have to wonder to yourself, like, why is he pulling out a checklist if he's had like years and years of training? Because he needed that plan, right? Like one thing after another, we need that plan in writing because our brain is hijacked at that point where we're in fight, flight, or freeze mode. So it's, planning is amazing. Having a checklist next to you, just like Captain Sully did, is amazing. And just remembering that it's okay to have that. You know, sometimes we need that. We need our tool bag, our coping skills tool bag, to actually be literal and written out and like right in front of us, right next to us.
Such a good point. Such a good point. You know, and no conversation about anxiety related to gifted kids would be complete without talking about perfectionism. Because, you know, if you are in that plane, if you are getting brain surgery, heart surgery, you want that person who's thought of every contingency. But that contingency simulating planning can become an overused skill where you can't be in the present. So for those of us who struggle with perfectionism, what, how should we be thinking about that?
Hello, I'm a recovering perfectionist. I think we should really evaluate our belief system around perfectionism, especially as educators, as therapists, as humans, as parents. I think a lot of us still have a little bit of pride when we say we're a perfectionist. I'm just a little perfectionist, you know, I'm just a little perfectionistic. I just like things to be perfect. When I meet kids who are perfectionists, they aren't going toward what I believe is a misnomer. And we're calling it perfectionism is really mastery. Right? We're talking about mastery. We want our kids to be gritty. We want them to go deep. We want them to be able to really focus, do deliberate practice. That's mastery. That's what we want. when the kids that I work with, when I see perfectionism, those kids are paralyzed. They don't ever want to be a work in progress. They don't ever want to say, well, they don't ever want to be Michael Jordan when he got cut from the team and he had to go practice at 6 a.m. every day, throwing the ball. They don't want to be in progress. They want to be at the end result. And so what happens to those kids is they are afraid to show up as who they are. They are afraid to show up authentically. They're afraid to show their flaws. And they always want to be done with that whole part, like the practicing part, right? They want to be at perfect already. So perfectionism, no good. No bueno, right? Not good at all. Perfectionism is not good because what happens is we get paralyzed, we lack authenticity. And so we have several exercises in the Superpowered book where we talk to kids about evaluating their perfectionism. Are you really going toward a goal or are you stuck? Are you the kid in class who doesn't want to raise their hand or on Zoom, you know, doesn't want to participate because you might say something that's not correct and you couldn't bear that? That's the kind of perfectionism. Some people call it healthy and unhealthy perfectionism. I just say that all perfectionism needs to be put to the side and we need to teach kids about mastery. And yeah. So, yeah, I really think the first step with perfectionism is to self-reflect. As adults, how do we think about it? You know,
that's a really good point. And that with perfectionism, there's a fear that goes with it. Whereas mastery, there's a hunger to learn. There's a light in the eyes. It's really totally different.
Yeah. It aligns a lot with Carol Dweck's work on mindset, you know, so perfectionists often have a fixed mindset where they believe, listen, I came into this world as I am. And so most of the time I am spending proving that perception of me. So if everyone's calling me smart or I have adopted that label for myself, then everything I do is a performance to show you that label is true, right?
And a risk of losing it.
Yes, of losing it. I mean, what would I be without it? Who would I be? Right? Yeah. And what would give me worth? Without that label.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's so interesting. And that's actually why I chose the words bright and quirky. Cause I don't love the word gifted because I think there is a lot of expectations that go along with it. I don't love diagnoses because they're labels. So it's like, let's just be bright and quirky.
Let's just be bright and quirky. I love that.
Well, Rini, it is an absolute joy to talk with you. How can people learn more about your work?
Thank you for asking and thank you for having me. You can go to gozen.com. So it's G-O-Z-E-N and all my work is there.
Yay. Thank you so much. This has been fantastic.
You're so welcome. Thanks, everyone.